The hope, done sensibly, is that the incentives for investment and economic growth will bring in enough growth and therefore tax revenue.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It is 12:11 here on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand in the Allstate Skyline Studio on this Wednesday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in. A little later in the program, we'll talk to Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business. I remember the name Rubschlager, the Little Breads. Well, they gave big money to Westside Hospital. In fact, they're going to have a cancer center named after them. That's one of the stories in Crane's today. We'll talk to Frank about that. But we get started on Wednesdays with Terry Savage, who has an extra gleam in her eye because she's just returned from European travel.
I did. I spent a week in Poland and a couple of days in Prague. And I am so wide awake right now because I'm jet lagged.
Well, that's the thing. So, people
I got a lot done this morning when I woke up at 4 a.m.
People come back from a trip and they take the next day off. Like, that's the day you get the most done because you're up at 4 in the morning.
Yeah, I landed about 8 and I've said, I'll be asleep by 10. And I was wide awake at 4 o'clock. I gave up.
Well, the Dow was up almost every day you were gone.
Yeah, I noticed that.
And then
the day I came back, it went down.
It was down yesterday, and it's down again today. I mean, what's going on? Anything we're worried about?
There's always something to worry about. We're sort of in this lull period here now, but what seems to be dominating the markets is the sense that things are slowing down. There's no inflation in sight, and it's just hard to believe that. It was January, what's not even quite 6 months, that the Fed was saying, well, maybe we'll have two or three interest rate hikes this
year.
Right,
and now it's two or three cuts.
And now it's two or three cuts that everybody's talking about. And that's changed scenarios a little bit. Let me see if I could paint this picture. So interest rates are down. The 10-year Treasury note now is down to 2.12% this morning. It was over 2.5% just slightly a few months ago. So that's a big decline. And short-term Treasury bills actually yield slightly more than the 10-year Treasury. That's an interest rate inversion.
So that's that inversion curve
exactly.
We talked about.
And while we have this talk about rate cuts and an economic slowdown, surprisingly, gold has been very strong. We have no inflation now, but if the Fed's going to cut interest rates and if we have more tariffs, not only could it throw the economy into the recession that ought to be coming along just on the law of averages now, but there's a sense that consumers could feel things in higher prices because businesses will have to pass them on. And all of that's thrown a bid into the gold market. So we have gold trading at $1,331, and that's, you know, that's moving up against some resistance around 1350. If it goes through there, boy, you could see a big move in gold.
And tell me about mortgage interest rates as well, right? Because we're talking about these going up and going up, and they're not going up.
Well,
and going
so
up.
That's the other thing. The housing market slowed down last fall, remember, and nobody was going to buy a house, and there was real concern on the part of home builders. And now we're seeing record refinancings. Refinancings this last month have been double what they were a year ago at this time. I always go on to guaranteedrate.com if I want to see what's really happening. And Guaranteed Rate is saying that they will refinance they will give you a 30-year loan, good credit, of course, at 3.87%. So that's under 4%. And at 3.97 APR. And 15 years. Now, watch this. If you have only 15 years or 18 years left on your mortgage, you can refinance now to 3.25%. Interest rate, the APR is a little higher, 3.4. But
and two or three years ago, we would have predicted to be much higher than that by now.
Absolutely. We were shocked, but we were in the middle of an economic slowdown. Rates came down. But now we've had a good economy, a good stock market, relatively speaking. And you have a chance to refinance your mortgage for 15 years at 3.25%. If your mortgage rate is over 4%, go do that right now.
Get it done.
Go do that right now, 3.25%, 15 years. Whoa.
Okay, so things are moving along. The interest rate cuts are coming, and yet there's this Duke study out saying I think 69% of executives expecting a recession by the end of next year. The number is 48% by, I think, the second quarter of next year.
Well, you know, but the law of averages, we are now in our longest economic recovery.
You can throw out the law of averages, right? We're way beyond anything measurable.
We are now the longest economic recovery from trough to peak. And, you know, there are those who would give the tax cuts and should give the tax cuts credit for lengthening the economic cycle, but we haven't repealed the economic cycles. And when you see if the threats of more tariffs, I can't, you know, I need to keep a scorecard. We need to put a big chalkboard up here because when the tariffs started, when they were threatened, when they went into effect, now what's threatened, now what's going into effect. And then we have to have a line for China. We have to have a line for Mexico.
It's like
a,
we need
a line
color
for the
code.
Rest of the world.
Right.
We really need to do some kind of graphic.
I had a guy in from the Canadian trade office last week, and I said, do we like you yet? I don't remember. We can't keep track if we like them or not.
Do you know that they are our largest trading partner? And they are our most positive balance of trade.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I did not know
that. Trying to remember what the numbers were with the last time I looked at it. Well, we have the fairest trading relationship with Canada in terms of balances, when you consider not just goods but services and financial transactions. We have a really terrific history of trade with Canada.
CNBC has a millionaire survey that they do from time to time. They talked about candidates for president. So Donald Trump, when it comes up against the Democrats among millionaires, Donald Trump loses pretty easily to Joe Biden. Wouldn't be a big surprise. I don't think that's a big surprise. 53% to 39%. Pete Buttigieg beats Donald Trump by 1%, 43% to 42%. But the president beats all the other Democrats.
You know, I'm waiting for the survey of billionaires. Yeah, to be impactful. Look, I think these surveys, you can concoct anything you want right now. There's a great, when you...
Well, they favored the millionaires, overwhelmingly favored Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Okay,
so,
I was going to say. You know, there's two aspects to this, and it's not going to work itself out. And we're going to have a lot of fun with numbers and surveys for the next 2 years. But there's the economic aspect, and whenever I talk to business people about it, you know, they're so glowing about the economic side of the ledger. I find it difficult to ask them because when you say, but what about the other issues?
Right.
Which into which you can lump everything from children in cages to women's rights to all the other things. And to me, I just don't see how the money can come first.
Well, there are two things coming out of the poll organizers. One said that a lot of Trump supporters tend to lay low, so his numbers might be better against Joe Biden than you would think. But then the other side of it, they said that Biden doing so well, while the economy is doing well and these millionaires are benefiting from tax cuts, shows that to those millionaires, the other stuff does matter more than just the money. So there's that. Terry Savage is here. You know, Terry and I talk a lot about fiduciary, and the fiduciary rule is it gone?
No, but the SEC has come up with something that makes you think that they've solved the problem. And I wrote it when I was away, and I just saw the edited copy as it's going into the paper. It's on my website now at terrysavage.com. And I went, whoo, I was really blowing smoke out of my ears, but I stand by it. SEC tried to pull the wool over our eyes.
So the fiduciary rule, they tried to get rid of it, and then they delayed
Right? You know, well, the Department of Labor... this spring, passed a rule that said anybody dealing with retirement plan advice, rollovers, and so forth, had to act as a fiduciary. This is my favorite word of the year of the last 2 years. Fiduciary means, number one, you fully disclose all fees, commissions, hidden incentives, the trip to Asia, or whatever it is, if you're a broker. And number two, you agree to put your client's interests ahead of your own interests as a broker and the interests of your firm. That's what a fiduciary is.
Okay, boy,
that's
what
we all want.
You're shaking your head at me, but there was a move to get rid of that.
So the Department of Labor was about to put that into effect. When the new administration came in and said, no, we got to rework this.
Okay.
So here we are 2 years later. And while I was away, and boy, my blood started to bubble when I was, you know, I'm on the internet all the time. The SEC passed a new rule, and it's got a great title.
You really were able to go away on vacation, huh?
Well, I'm always watching. And the new rule was called the best interest standard. And the idea was that people would think that now all brokers and salespeople would be having the best interests of the client first. And Wall Street waved a flag and said, see, we did it. We created our own, quote, version that's sort of like the fiduciary rule. The truth of the matter is... Wall Street did not like the fiduciary rule. It's a complicated. But first of all, it made, you know, all of a sudden they had to show everything. They had to lift their skirts. So then they decided, well, we'll just charge an annual fee. And then people realized that was a lot of money to pay for advice to sit in the same funds. So Wall Street came up and got behind this thing called the best interest rule. It got passed and everybody went, yay, we've got the best interest rule. Now we're the good guys. And it has a loophole so huge that it isn't the fiduciary standard by any means. It says, well, yeah, it's okay. We'll have your best interests at heart. Unless we give you advice, it's sort of incidental to buying or selling the business of purchasing investments.
What does that mean?
What it means is basically nobody's looking out for you, the little guy, unless you find a financial advisor that agrees to take and put in writing on the company letterhead the fiduciary pledge. It's in the column. It's up on my website. If you search my columns for the word fiduciary, you'll probably find half a dozen or more of them over the last 2 years. The fiduciary agrees to fully disclose all fees, costs, commissions, and incentives, and to put your interests ahead of his or her own or the firm's. You can find those. The National Association of Personal Financial Advisors are fee-only advisors, NAPFA.org. Wealthfront.com, which lets you search, Wealthfront.com lets you search for fiduciary financial advisors. Look, this doesn't mean that I have a lot of friends who are stockbrokers and financial advisors. Now they're going to be forced to say, look, I'm happy to fully disclose everything and write down on a pledge that I am a fiduciary. That can be done. It doesn't mean that they can't charge you fees or commissions, but that they must give you the products that are best suited for you and fully disclose all those fees and commissions.
That is up at terrysavage.com. Read the column that she wrote in anger, but it was edited down a little bit.
I wrote it in a fever. In surprise. It was like very Orwellian that they could title something the best interest rule, and when it clearly has so many loopholes and exemptions that it's not a best interest. So if some broker or some financial salesperson says, hey, we subscribe to the best interest rule, say, but will you write down that you subscribe to the fiduciary pledge?
Okay, we have 1 minute left. Okay. Another thing I read and I was talking to you about, I did not realize that companies could automatically enroll you in their 401k, that they didn't have to ask you.
That's a new thing. As a matter of fact, it's the default
under George
in many
W.
corporations.
And the idea was that it will get you to learn to save if you'll realize that you won't really notice it. Now I'm reading
it's sort
that,
of like FICA. You know, you,
right.
What are you going to do about it? It's taken out.
But now I'm realizing that, or reading that, when you can opt out of it, but now even when you opt out of it, companies are for a second time or even a third time re-opting you back in.
Yeah, look, it's about time we did something nice for people, especially companies that match your contributions. So the thought was, and it worked, that if instead of saying, do you want to save? No, I can't afford that taken out of my paycheck. They automatically opt people into the 401k plan. Then those people get the match. It's like doubling your money in many cases.
Yeah, but aren't they're taking my money without my consent.
They're not taking it. It's in an account with your name on it. And
companies have said,
well, if you didn't opt in the first time because you, or if you opted out, or if when you were working for this company, when we started our plan, we didn't have that automatic opt-in. They're making a double effort to get people to save. This is like eating broccoli.
And I kind of like it. I mean, I like that people are forced to get into the habit.
Yeah.
I get it. It's good. But it just seems odd to me that if I say, no, please don't do that, that you can again do it. And if you take the money, put it in the account, I don't have access to it for 25, 30 years.
Well, good. That's a whole idea. I mean, you could pay a penalty and take it out and pay ordinary taxes. Look, we know there's a crisis. And here's the most critical thing. We know time is money. So a dollar, $100 saved when you're 25 is worth far, far more than a dollar when you start saving at 50.
Terry Savage, great to see you again. Thanks for coming by.
See you next week.
Thanks very much, Eric Rung. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Okay, in the studio, Chris Vandenberg is here. He's the CFO of Ambulance Transportation, Inc. And I've got so many questions about ambulances. Chris, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
All right, so first of all, the name of the company is Ambulance Transportation, Inc., but you have several sort of different sub-brands that people see driving up and down the highways with their lights on, right?
Yeah, so we operate ATI Ambulance. We also operate Vandenberg Ambulance and Trace Ambulance. And so depending on where you're at in the city, you may see different brands. And that's just because we've had different companies over the years, and they've sort of merged together. So,
and how many ambulances in all?
We have about 100 ambulances and wheelchair vans. We employ about 500 people. We do over 100,000 transports a year.
So. Really? No kidding. And so here's my question. Well, here's one of my questions. When I see you coming up behind me with your lights on, am I supposed to pull over?
You are.
Am I really?
Yes.
Because, I wonder about that. I'm thinking, well, this must be a non-emergency situation, so They're just making us. So yeah. Why would you have the lights on? Of course, yeah. I should pull over.
So the laws absolutely govern when we can use them and when we can't use them. And so when the lights are on, we're absolutely responding to an emergency. So while we might not be going to a car crash, we may be going to an emergency situation where we're working with a nursing home or assisted living and somebody's having a medical event that we're responding to.
So if I see you, honestly, so if you're coming up behind me and I see those lights on and it's a private ambulance, I'm supposed to pull over.
Yes.
Do you think, do people do that?
It's a challenge. They don't do it for the municipals. Ambulances very often, right. And so the privates, it's certainly a bigger challenge for us, and it's really a safety issue for both our patients and our crew.
Chris, I'm sorry, because I certainly do for municipals, but I just didn't realize that was the case for. I thought, you just had the lights, so you were using them. Who's in the ambulance?
So we have a couple different levels of services. So we have the basic life support that are the two EMTs. You have the advanced life support. So those are the paramedics. Those are typically what you would see the equivalent of on the municipal fire department side. And then we also have another level that's critical care. Those are folks that are trained above the paramedic level. So they can do considerably more than the paramedics. There's 30 different medications that aren't available for paramedics that they can transport with. There's chest tubes, there's 12 lead monitors, there's ventilators. So really, when you're looking at the critical care vehicles, those are really ICUs that are mobile.
Wow. And they're taking people generally from one hospital to another, from a nursing home to a hospital, or how about that? What are your transfers?
The bulk of the business that we're doing are inter-facilities, so they're going from hospitals to nursing homes. The critical care and the ones that you're seeing with the lights on, they're either going to a hospital or they're bringing them from one hospital to another hospital. So, for instance, we do work with a lot of the community hospitals, and they need to be transported to the higher level, the trauma centers, the academic.
So they wouldn't use a municipal for that. They would use a private ambulance.
Correct.
Do any hospitals around here have their own ambulance service?
In the Chicago metro area, there are some in the western suburbs that do have their own. They're usually operated by an ambulance company and branded that way.
Okay.
As you get downstate, there are hospital-owned ambulance companies.
And why is it that downstate they own their own ambulances, but they don't up here?
In Chicago, it's just the density of people. So there's enough transportation volume that the private industry can sustain itself.
You couldn't run a business down there.
Correct. It'd be really difficult.
Okay. All right. Here's the weirdest question you're going to have all day. You've been in this business for your whole life, pretty much, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, when I was a kid, I'm older than you, but when I was a kid, I grew up in a small town, and we called it wasn't an ambulance, we called it an inhalator.
Yes.
Have you heard of that?
I have heard of it, and actually,
Chris, I'm so happy to hear that. No one has ever heard of that.
Yeah. My dad, I can remember growing up hearing stories about the inhalator and getting the inhalator out there and making sure that they have it. And times really have changed. And like I said, the equipment that's in the back of the critical care ambulance right now is really what you would find in an ICU. And so that's where things have changed, where, even 10, 12 years ago, the cost of a new ambulance with everything in it would cost, $75,000. Today, with the equipment that's in them, they're upwards of $150,000, and that's
right?
On the private side.
Yeah, because when the inhalator went out, it was just a couple of volunteer firemen in the back getting you to the hospital as soon as you could.
Correct.
So you really are a medical company as much as anything, a transportation company, maybe more so.
It's more so, and I think really as you've seen the industry develop and change, I think, for us, one of our largest struggles is working with the hospital partners and the partners that we have, saying, we're not just the transportation. You need to involve us in the care coordination that you're doing, because, for instance, you're hearing, some of the catchwords now are care coordination and reducing readmissions. Well, when we're bringing folks home from the hospital, we're seeing things that really I don't think occur to a lot of people that are used to dealing in a clinical setting, where,
right,
making sure they have food, making sure that they have, really a safe passage when they're at home, where, okay, great, they've been discharged with a hip fracture, but, they're going to be walking around with their walker and there's a rug, but you want to keep the carpet clean, so you put a rug on top of the carpet. And
so the hospitals or the nursing homes, they need to see you more as an outpost of a medical facility rather than an Uber.
Years and years ago, really you would see people going out in the community and treating patients. I think that we're over healthcare. I think it's going to evolve back there. And I think using EMS and private ambulance companies to be going out and saying, okay, there's some things that we just don't do really well in the hospital. We don't want the patient there for that. But let's send the ambulance out there so that they're doing the basic care, and then using telehealth to come back to the doctor.
No kidding.
Or back to the hospital.
And is that something your company would move into, or would you think that would become then more hospital-centric?
That's something that we're working with some of our hospital partners on, and we're having discussions with them about how does this actually work and what are you doing on that side.
Healthcare law has had a big impact on you?
It has. It's as an employer, obviously, it added costs to us.
But like all of us, yeah.
But for us, really, what you're looking at is you're seeing these high-deductible plans that have existed. And so now you have somebody where we used to get a check from Blue Cross. Now we're sending the bill to the patient, and so we're working on that. And so it's changing the payment cycles that we're having. And so that's, one of the things that we're talking about with having Wintrust as a partner. That's very important for us so that they understand what we're doing.
And Wintrust does that well? Is that one of the things?
They do a great job on it. And for us, really, what we like about working with Wintrust is, they have the old school banking mentality where they're getting to know us, get to know what we're doing in our business, and providing that level of service, but then having basically the big bank capabilities.
In a way, what you want the hospitals to learn and know about you, Wintrust does for you.
Correct.
That's why Chris Vandenberg is a Wintrust community leader. Thanks for coming in. You've changed my life now. I'm going to be much more attentive when I see your employers with their lights on.
You're going to see the ambulances all the time now, and you're going to be looking to say, hey, what's the name on the side of it?
I'm going to start following them just to see where they're going. Chris Vandenberg, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day.
All right, time to stroke the ego.
Chicago is a startup hub, and we have the incredibly intelligent people to prove it. Just look at Brad Keywell. He won the EY World Entrepreneur of the Year Award. This guy's been working for like 49 years straight. He founded Uptake, an industrial AI software company, Lightbank, a venture capital investment firm, and Groupon, just to name a few. This guy clearly sees the world a little differently from you and me, but he says that entrepreneurship is not just about being a mold breaker, it's also about being a mold maker and finding a more intuitive and direct path to where you want to be. That's the kind of thinking that'll change the world. And it looks like the Obama Library will be changing the Jackson Park area as the challenge in court to prevent it from being built has failed. Protect Our Parks is one of the groups that has been continually pushing against the development, but the group isn't giving up as they plan on filing an appeal. So this will have lots of continued talk around it. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thank you, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's Bank. We're on 720 WGN in the Allstate Skyline Studio on this Tuesday afternoon. And on the phone line now is Frank Sennett, who, well, we can't tell he's on the phone, but he may well have a frosty beverage in his hand right now.
Always thinking about one, anyway.
I'm fascinated by this story, the feud that started at the Super Bowl between InBev and Miller Coors. Continues to this day. Not only does it continue, but in a way they're shooting themselves in their own feet now, right? There was this cooperative spending plan, this marketing plan that Miller Coors is going to stay out of because they're still ticked off at InBev.
Yeah, so there's been this feud that's been happening since the Super Bowl ads by Anheuser-Busch InBev targeted Miller, saying that they use corn syrup in their formulation, and Miller Coors pushed back and got a ruling from the feds that they had to take some of the language out, that there's not corn syrup in the finished product, et cetera. But InBev really has gotten under their skin. There's an industry-wide generic promotion for, drinking beer that all of the big players right. are supposed to fund. And Miller Coors says until Anheuser-Busch InBev starts playing nicer, they're not going to come in on it. And then Constellation Brands and Anheuser-Busch InBev are funding it so far. Miller Coors is staying on the sidelines.
I think Heineken USA
is also staying on the sidelines until everybody agrees to play nice as well. So half the players are not funding this initiative.
Is Heineken staying out because they're on Miller Coors' side, or because they just don't want to pour their beer money into a marketing plan that's not going to really work?
Well, what or they're saying be, is they support anyway, the yeah. initiative in principle, but that they will only be coming in if everybody's in agreement.
The point is that people aren't drinking beer the way they used to, or they're drinking liquor more than they are beer. And the beer industry is not only under attack from the spirits industry and wine growth, the craft beers, things like that. So we got to figure out a way to get people to drink this beer, and they need the marketing help.
Don't you think that there's a space in the market for a beer company to have some clever ads that have like the two big beverages companies fighting
over
and
each other.
They're the beverage for adults, you know.
Yeah.
While everybody else is fighting, we're just going to give you some good beer.
The problem, Frank, is who would it be? Because it seems like these two big companies, or the three or four big companies, own all the littler companies now too.
It's true. It's a big conglomerate. But as you say, beer sales volume is flat year to date, period ending June 2nd, and spirits are growing nearly 5%. So they do need to, you know, put aside their differences probably at some point and get some promotion out there.
I mean, you know, the beer drinking has changed, or the industry, the drinking, I'll say, has changed so much in the past 10 or 15 years. I mean, it started maybe with Goose Island 25 mm-hmm. years ago. But, you know, I know that these beers are less expensive than a lot of the craft beers, but they, you know, they have a hard time competing when it comes to flavor and all of that. I suppose they'll be around forever just because they're cheap, a cheaper choice.
Yeah, but they as publicly traded companies, they're, you know, always spurred on to growth. So, you know, if they just manage for decline, that's not going to be too good for their shareholders.
Hey, I told my audience earlier today that I would ask you to spell Rübschlager for me.
I heard that.
You know, I used to get the Rübschlager company used to send me, and a lot of people around the station, a case of Rübschlager bread every year at Christmas time. It was kind of a tradition. And they were the little tiny cocktail loaves. But who knew those little loaves led to such big money? And now Rush is naming this $450 million outpatient center after the Rübschlagers.
Yeah, it's a 10-story, 480,000 square foot Joan and Paul Rübschlager building. It's going to be near Rush's near West Side headquarters, right next door. And it's the latest outpatient facility and the first of theirs to focus solely on the complex medical conditions of cancer. And the donors, both of them, underwent cancer treatment at the hospital. So they, you know, were so grateful they donated the money to help create the new center.
What I like, too, in the story written by Stephanie Goldberg, she points out that the Rübschlagers also would bring their workers to the hospital when they needed treatment, which really, I think, seems to say something pretty powerful about the company.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they clearly are one of those family-owned businesses that cares about their workers, and clearly they care about the care they got at Rush, and so they gave them the largest single gift in Rush's history.
All right, so you didn't spell Rübschlager. You can write it out and send it to me in email if you'd like.
It'll be in the mail.
Frank Sennett from Crane Chicago Business. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you, Steve.